The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking are not necessarily the views of this station, its affiliates, sponsors, or advertisers.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is, cause we're Skeptically Speaking.
Hello and welcome to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Shell. I'm here with Cy Curious, postdoctoral researcher with professional interests in neurophysiology, specifically the interactions of neurotransmitter systems. She posts at Scientific American under the Cy Curious Brain, and she's the author of the Neurotic Physiology blog. Welcome back, Cy.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
Now, today we're talking about drugs, specifically the drugs that get one high. So drugs are grouped into classes, correct?
In general, yeah.
So what classes are we talking about?
The main classes that we usually talk about when we talk about addictive drugs can be broken down into groups such as the opiates, the depressants, which are different from the opiates, the psychostimulants, the hallucinogens, the cannabinoids, and then there are other drugs that don't fit comfortably into any of those categories, and some of them that actually kind of bridge the gap. For example, ecstasy or MDMA kind of bridges the gap between a psychostimulant and a hallucinogen.
Do all the drugs in a class work the same way neurologically, or are they grouped that way just because they have the same effect but different mechanics?
It kind of depends. The opiates are called opiates because they all work the same way. Stimulants do not. The depressants, which do not actually make you depressed, they depress you physiologically in the physical aspect. Those are actually very different from each other. There's a couple of subcategories of those. And of course, different scientists actually do different drug groupings based on their personal opinions on these matters.
Well, maybe let's just start right in to some of these, maybe beginning with opiates. So what are they?
When you think of opiates, opiates are called opiates after opium, a reference to the opium poppy, which is the original opiate, which was smoked, actually. Opium was originally smoked. Opiates include things like morphine and heroin, which I'm sure everyone's heard of. They include opium. They also include drugs like codeine and OxyContin. And these drugs all act the same way. So first I need to say that drugs of abuse, when we think of drugs that are addictive, the main category that these all fall in is they all in some way increase dopamine in the nucleus accumbens of the brain. The nucleus accumbens is, if you drill in from your ears about 3 inches on either side, you'll hit it. And this is an area that's associated with reward, motivation, feelings of pleasure and high. And it's also associated with something we call salience, which is the amount of attention that you need to give to something at a specific time. So all drugs of abuse that are addictive are thought to elevate dopamine. We have yet to find one that doesn't. And the opiates do elevate dopamine, but they actually do it in a way that is indirect. They do it via hitting opioid receptors. Very convenient the way we name these things, opioid receptors. Incidentally, it is called dopamine for a reason. Dopamine.
Nicely done.
Okay.
Nicely done.
Yes. But opiates hit opioid receptors. These are the mu opioid receptor, the delta opioid receptor, the kappa opioid receptor. And you don't have these receptors in your brain because, you know, just in case some opium might come along one day and make your day. You have these receptors because you actually produce endogenous opioids in your brain. And these help to do things like produce pain dulling effects along with other things. But opiates kind of hijack that system. Drugs of abuse in general hijack normal physiological systems. So opiates in general, very highly addictive. Interestingly, so morphine had been around for a while and people got the hint that morphine was extremely addictive. So they started looking for other drugs which could kill pain but were not as addictive. And they discovered heroin and they started marketing it as like this wonder drug, this pain drug that was not addictive. And we all know how that turned out. Sadly, it turned out as Requiem for a Dream.
Oh, no one watch that movie. Don't do it.
No,
don't
never
do it.
Watch
It'll
it.
It'll ruin your life. Well, then what's the difference in the effect between something like heroin and something like OxyContin?
The difference in the effect has to do with the route of administration, the speed of onset, and the affinity that these drugs have for their receptors. So how tightly they bind to the receptors, how long they bind for. Heroin has very strong effects because you have to inject it or smoke it. It gets into the body very, very quickly. It gets into the brain very, very quickly. And because it gets there so quickly, you get a big rush associated with it. You get the high. For OxyContin, it tends to last longer. Because it lasts longer, and because you normally take it as a pill, you don't get as big of a rush. You do still get one. And of course, people who abuse OxyContin, and they really, really do, will either take it as a pill or they will also, for example, grind it up and inject it.
How are opiates studied exactly?
Opiates are studied in the same way that most drugs of abuse are studied, in the laboratory with usually rats. Though we do studies in humans. Basically, you can do studies in humans using things like fMRI or PET, which are imaging systems, but you can't really... The humans really protest when you open up their brain and try to like poke around in there. They don't like it. So
fascinating.
Rats. So with all drugs of abuse, we tend to... The gold standard for abusable drugs in the laboratory is rodent self-administration. And this is where you take a rat, or sometimes a mouse. You can also do this in monkeys. And you put a little catheter into its back, where it can't reach it, that goes directly into a vein. And you put that catheter and you hook it up to a syringe. You then put the rat in a cage with a lever, and the lever is connected to the syringe, which is connected to the catheter. The rat hangs around the cage, wanders around, explores. Eventually, he's going to bump into the lever. When he does, it triggers the syringe. The syringe injects a nice shot of heroin, I guess, in this case, into its vein, and it gets a nice little shot right there. And if the drug is rewarding and reinforcing to the rat, it's going to figure out pretty quickly what you need to do to that lever.
Right.
And so you can compare drugs. You can look at psychostimulants. You can look at opiates. You can look at all sorts of different kinds of drugs. And see how the rats lever press for them. You can change the schedules to see how much a rat, you know, likes a drug, quote unquote likes. So for example, if you want to see how much motivation a rat has to take, say, cocaine, you put it on something called a progressive ratio schedule, which is where you have it press once, it gets a shot of cocaine. So it goes, okay, that's awesome. It goes to press again. This time it has to press twice. After that, it has to press 4 times,
oh.
Then 16 times, then 32 times, then 64 times. And so each time it has to press more and more and more and more until basically it finally tells you the price, quote unquote, at which this just isn't worth it.
We have a question from Elizabeth via Twitter. And this question really applies to a bunch of the drugs that we're going to talk about, but let's focus on opiates to begin with.
Why do addicts often relapse? What are the most effective treatments?
Well, why do addicts relapse? Addiction is actually defined as a relapsing disorder. That's the definition of addiction. It's a chronic relapsing disorder. So we tend to think of it as a dysregulation of systems in your brain associated with reward and motivation. You rely on the drug for your own sense of reward, motivation, pleasure, and it becomes a craving, a severe craving. And so relapse comes from giving in to that craving, which is extremely strong. It's often physical. There's often physical symptoms that go along with it. It is extremely strong. It can be triggered by being in the same area as where you last did drugs. If you drove the car you last got high in,
right,
you can trigger craving. If you see the friend that you used to get high with, you could trigger craving. And these can all lead to relapse. For treatment, well, there are several available treatments for various kinds of drugs. The issue is there is no gold standard of treatment because there is no treatment that is 100% effective. There is no treatment that is 50% effective. There is no treatment that is 25% effective. Something like, I think 95% of addicts will relapse at least once, usually way more than that. I'd have to look up the exact statistics. The most successful so far, according to the medical literature, is a combination of psychotherapy, like group therapy or personal therapy, combined with a drug to help with the cravings. So for like opiates, you can use methadone, which is a really, really long acting drug that you take either as a liquid or as a pill, and it's long-acting enough that it controls some of the craving and physical symptoms, allowing you to kind of get along with your life. For things like stimulants, we can sometimes co-treat with antidepressants. With nicotine, there's the patch. Right. There's several treatment options, but most of them are not very effective.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking. I'm here with Cy Curious, postdoctoral researcher with professional interests in neurophysiology. And we're talking about recreational drugs. Let's go to hallucinogens. What falls into this category?
It's pretty wide category, but they do all work basically the same way. This includes LSD, which is lysergic acid diethylamide, that's your classic. There's psilocybin, mescaline, and there's various other synthetics that are classified as hallucinogens. Hallucinogens are very different from most of the other drug categories. They're different from psychostimulants, they're different from opiates, because they cause, you know, hallucinations. And because of their mechanism of action, they focus on the neurotransmitter serotonin, not dopamine. And in fact, there aren't really dopaminergic effects of most hallucinogens. There are some exceptions to that. But it's not really a high. It's an altered sensory state, but it's not, you don't really get a rush in general from taking a hallucinogen.
I was looking through a lot of different resources for this show. So what's in LSD nowadays?
Probably some original LSD, which has to be synthesized in a lab. It does not occur naturally. Probably some similar drugs that are agonists at the serotonin receptors. The serotonin receptor that causes the major sensory changes is the serotonin 2A receptor. And it's called 2A because there's between 14 and 17 different kinds of serotonin receptors. There's a lot to choose from here, but 2A is thought to be the one responsible for the altered sensory states. So, I mean, there could be other psychedelics in modern LSD containing, you know, compounds that activate 2A.
But it's not the same as it was, let's say, in the 60s.
It might be. The one drug I know that's really changed since its original appearance in terms of what you get on the street is actually MDMA. LSD, I think you mostly still get LSD. I'm not sure about that, though.
I love how that's not a certainty in any sense.
Yeah.
We have an email from Jen.
What's the deal with acid flashbacks?
So acid flashbacks, we call them in the laboratory, we call them hallucinogen persisting perception disorder, HPPD. And this is actually, it's pretty recent. Not that people haven't only recently started having flashbacks, but the research is very recent. There's right. only like 24 papers out on it, which is really not a lot. When you compare to like cocaine, which I think has 30,000 papers on it. So far, we don't actually know. The thought currently is that it's serotonin drug specific. So it has to be a drug that has serotonergic effects. And primarily serotonergic effects, ones that alter sensory states. You're not going to get it from opiates. You're not going to get it from cocaine. We think that it might be caused by changes in serotonin receptors after prolonged exposure to these drugs. And this can cause chronic problems in the way you process sensory information. We call it sensory gating. And this is thought to produce these visual disturbances and flashbacks after chronic use. It's correlated with how many times you've used it. You're more likely, the more hallucinogens you do, the more likely you are to have it. But it is still pretty uncommon.
And is that something that would last forever? Or does that have sort of a shelf life?
People complain about it for decades.
Ooh.
Yeah. But those are case studies. It's a tough thing to study in the lab.
Right. And now you mentioned MDMA. I'm very interested in this because that is something that when ecstasy first came out back in the day, it was MDMA was in ecstasy. But that is not necessarily the case now.
They don't think so. It's hard to really determine. You'd have to get samples of what everyone was using and run them through tests and find out exactly what's in it. But there are lots of drugs that are similar to MDMA, which are a little easier to synthesize. You can try to synthesize MDMA and get something else instead. You know, this isn't exactly being synthesized in a controlled fashion here. So some people have shown that modern MDMA, that you think you're getting ecstasy, in fact, you're getting a mixture of MDMA and mephedrone, or 4-MMC, which they call bath salts. But MDMA is interesting. It's a... It has the dopaminergic effects of psychostimulants. So it increases dopamine in the nucleus accumbens, but it has major serotonin effects, which also cause altered sensory states, though not full hallucinations. And via the serotonin system, it's been shown to have oxytocin effects, which they think is responsible for the whole, like, friendly, touchy-feely
right.
thing.
Well, now, you mentioned that it's hard to study these. And being that these drugs are illegal, some of them, how do researchers get their hands on them?
That's actually, I get that question a lot. The first time people ask about that, the first thing is, so where do you get the drugs? And the answer is, we have this guy. And he lives by the railroad tracks. And we send the first-year graduate student. No, we don't really do that. When you study drugs in the laboratory, you want to make sure that you're working with the drug. You want to know what you're using. You want to know how much you're using. You want to know how pure it is. I can only speak for how the United States handles this, but you get approval from the government by filling out many, many, many forms that you are going to perform certain experiments, usually ones you already have funding for, from the National Institutes of Health or National Science Foundation or some other agency, using particular drugs. If you, say, get permission to test cocaine, you tell the government exactly how much you need. You have to justify how much that is, what you're going to be using it for. The government will send you a drug.
Fascinating.
It is pure, and like pure cocaine in a bottle. You have to keep it locked up behind something like 3 different locked barriers. And every bit of the drug that you use is monitored to the nearest 0.0001 grams. So don't spill anything. And you have to keep records of what you use, when you use it, you know, who used it. Everything has to be signed. And if the government finds problems with your drug logs, you will never conduct those studies again.
Okay, so now that we've terrified all the potential drug researchers out there, that's
it's not
no
that
problem.
Awful. I mean, there's a lot of forms, but it's actually very useful. I mean, you think, oh man, that sucks. I mean, it makes it hard the first time, but you know, once you've filled out one set of forms, you can fill out more forms. And the thing is, when you're testing these, you have to know exactly what is in those drugs. You can't have, you know, MDMA and some other stuff going into your rat. You don't want that because then your studies will not be replicable. You won't get the same results every time. And in the case of humans, you want to be able to determine what doses humans exhibit certain subjective effects at.
Right.
So, for example, with marijuana, the marijuana that is given out by the government, which there is, has specific concentrations of the active ingredient, delta-9 tetrahydrocannabinol. This is actually kind of useful because you know exactly how much produces certain subjective effects in humans right. when you are studying it.
You mentioned pot, and we're going to keep all the marijuana-related questions sort of till the end of the show because I know how this works. We start talking about it, and we're not going to talk about anything else. So what I do want to know about are those other natural hallucinogens, things like mushrooms and peyote.
Yeah.
Are they somehow better, and you can't see my air quotes, better than the chemical versions?
Psilocybin is actually derived from mushrooms, so psilocybin and shrooms are basically the same thing. It's actually a prodrug. It's not the active drug. It has to be broken down in your body first, and then it gets converted to psilocin. And this has high affinity for the serotonin 2A receptor, which is the one that produces the altered sensory states. Mescaline is derived from peyote, which is a cactus, also 2A. So basically, the affinity for the 2A, as far as we can tell currently, we could be wrong, determines the altered sensory states associated with hallucinogens. I don't know whether they're better. They're slightly different experiences because they have different affinities for different serotonin receptors.
Do the, again, I'm going to use natural in air quotes, but do the earth-grown ones actually work neurologically the same way as something like MDMA?
MDMA is synthesized. You can't grow MDMA
right,
in
right.
anything. But certainly other psychostimulants, I mean, cocaine comes from a plant. Mephedrone is a derivative of an amphetamine-like thing that comes from khat, which is a plant from the Middle East. And many of the psychostimulants and hallucinogens that we think of that are now synthesized were based on naturally found compounds. For example, LSD, it is actually an alkaloid that is based on ergot. Ergotamine is the alkaloid. And ergot is a fungus that occurs on wheat and rye. It's rye, mostly. And it produces this this disease called St. Anthony's Fire, which is really nasty and deadly and seizures, and but it also has hallucinations. And so they were looking at, into ergotamine and how it worked, and they discovered LSD.
Oh, I love scientists. So are hallucinogens addictive?
That's a debatable point. Mm-hmm. For example, by the gold standard of rats pressing levers to administer drugs, you cannot get a rat to take a hallucinogen. They really don't like it. Is that because LSD is not addictive, or is that because if you're a rat and you're having sensory perception changes, are you really not enjoying yourself?
Right.
Part of the reason people like hallucinogens is because they are expecting a certain experience. It's tough to say. They don't tend to have strong dopaminergic effects associated with highly addictive drugs. You don't get a lot of people coming in complaining of being addicted to LSD.
Right.
It can't be determined for certain right now, but I would not say it is classically addictive, personally.
There are so many recreational drugs that are used to treat medical disorders as well. Is there any kind of non-recreational beneficial use for hallucinogens?
There's a few tests that have been conducted for them, usually in things like PTSD, trying to do guided therapy during your trip. And the results on that have been kind of mixed. Sometimes they've been positive. The studies on LSD are difficult because there is such a stigma associated with LSD in particular. It's a Schedule 1, which is like really, really scheduled. It's considered by the government to be one of the worst drugs, worst in quotes, in terms of their drug schedules. And that makes studies on it very, very difficult.
And we'll be right back to talk more about drugs with Psy Curious after this.
Skeptically Speaking wants you to question everything. To be a part of the discussion, call and record your question on our listener question line at Speak 73101. That's 773-257-3101. Long-distance charges may apply. Sunday nights at 6 Mountain Time, join our Ustream chat room to listen and ask questions as we record interviews live. Just click the Listen Online button at skepticallyspeaking.com. You can also email your questions and comments to live@skepticallyspeaking.com, or if you're on Twitter, tweet us at Skeptical Radio. To find out where Skeptically Speaking airs near you, to listen to past episodes, or download the weekly podcast, check out our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. While you're there, follow the links to connect with us on our Facebook page, our Twitter feed, or to subscribe to the show in iTunes. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell. And today's episode is all about recreational drugs. Here to sort it all out is Psy Curious, postdoctoral researcher with professional interests in neurophysiology and the blogger behind those Friday Weird Science posts that you see everyone retweeting. Now, on to stimulants. What Woo! Kind of drugs are stimulants? What falls into that category?
Stimulants are my favorite. I didn't mean it like that. Okay, but this is the one that I know the most about. When we talk about, I know I mentioned earlier that drugs of abuse are thought to be abused and addictive in the most general sense, because they increase dopamine in a particular area of the brain, the nucleus accumbens. There's lots of other brain areas involved, but this is the one we often think of. And psychostimulants are the ones that really do that directly. They actually interfere with the dopamine transporter. You know that when cells signal to one another, you release a neurotransmitter, in this case, dopamine. It goes into the space between the cells and it latches onto receptors on the other side, and the signal gets carried on into the wild, and it's great. But you don't want your dopamine to remain sitting there in the extracellular space, stimulating your receptors over and over again. That's bad. So you have transporters, which recycle the dopamine back up into the cell that released it or into other cells for either breaking it down or repackaging to be used again. So these transporters, when you block them, you stop their ability to recycle. And the dopamine, in this case, will build up in the extracellular space, stimulating again and again and again and again. And it's this spike in extracellular dopamine that you can actually see it in things like in vivo microdialysis or in voltammetry. When you stimulate dopamine neurons, you can actually see the effects of cocaine prolonging the release of dopamine and prolonging the amount of dopamine in the synapse. And you can see this big whoosh of dopamine as it goes up. And cocaine, methamphetamine, MDMA to some extent, Ritalin, amphetamine, all of those drugs will create that effect.
Well, you've told me that you find cocaine far more interesting than things like hallucinogens or cannabis. Why is that?
Mostly because it's one of the ones I know the most about. I also find it to be interesting because it's not toxic. It creates these very different behaviors, and it's this very, it's a very, very drastic behavioral difference. And that's always very interesting to see. But also it creates all of these subtle differences. And it's just very, it's one of those things where looking at the subtle differences in things like receptor numbers in specific areas of the brain, the amount that a neuron fires at base level, things like that. And all of these things can create an addict. And we haven't yet worked out which of those things create an addict and which are just side effects. Does it take all of these things? So I think cocaine is a very good, a very useful drug to study in terms of looking at how addiction occurs. Of course, addiction may occur very differently for each of the drugs that we're talking about, and we can't really say. But I think it's a very interesting drug to look at because we're pretty clear, you know, it blocks dopamine transporters, serotonin transporters, norepinephrine transporters. That is what it does. And since we've got that worked out, we can start working out how addiction might occur.
What's the effect of higher dosages or the length of time that you use the drug? Is there a completely different effect, or how does tolerance work?
So higher doses, I mean, it depends on tolerance. So the main effects you're going to get when you first do like a smaller dose of cocaine, you're going to get increased alertness, focus, insomnia, anorexia, which is the clinical term for lack of appetite, not actually the eating disorder, though it is that too. As the doses get higher, you go all the way up to panic, heart attacks, and death. Now, so tolerance, basically, when someone does a drug of abuse, and tolerance occurs to all of them, you get that whoosh of dopamine, that, you know, whoosh of whatever you're looking at. And the first time, it's extremely powerful. The salience is very powerful. You want to do this again. But your brain begins to adapt to those higher levels. And the brain changes to adapt to these levels. And after a while, the same dose doesn't get you as high anymore. And you have to take more. And that is tolerance. But one of the weird things about tolerance is that for some drugs, in fact, for many drugs, tolerance to some effects will occur while other effects will not have as much tolerance. So for example, with the opiate, you'll get high tolerance to the pain effects, but other effects you may not get as much tolerance to. Like, I think you don't get as much tolerance to the constipating effects of opiates.
That's fair. Okay, I have to ask about this. Methamphetamines. What the hell is with meth?
Methamphetamine is the one drug that I can't talk about without cussing. I actually got in trouble while teaching a high school class once when somebody asked about methamphetamine, and I said, that is the most motherfucking scary drug I've ever heard of. It's really, really terrifying.
Why is it so terrifying, Sai?
Well, it has all the usual psychostimulant effects. So it has that big increase in dopamine. In this case, it's methamphetamine not only blocks the dopamine transporter, it actually reverses it. And then it goes into the vesicular monoamine transporter and reverses that too, dumping piles of dopamine out into the synapse, just piles upon piles. When you see the curves of dopamine effect with cocaine and methamphetamine, it does not even compare. Like, cocaine will increase dopamine 2 or 3 times. Methamphetamine, you're looking at 10, 15 times. Massive, massive. And it's also got some serotonin effects, hallucinations, particularly sensory ones. That cause people to think they have things under their skin, and they'll tear at their skin. It does horrible things to your teeth. It's called meth mouth. They don't know how it happens. It appears to not be an effect of the drug. It seems to be a combination of the compulsive teeth grinding, which is associated with methamphetamine use, the dry mouth, which is associated with methamphetamine use, and the bad hygiene, which happens when you're an addict. And it's one of the only major drugs that we know actually kills your neurons. Cocaine does not kill your neurons. Morphine does not kill your neurons. Methamphetamine kills your neurons. It's particularly toxic to dopamine neurons, and prolonged use of crystal meth that actually increases your risk drastically for Parkinson's disease due to all the dopamine neuron death. So it's really unpleasant.
We have a question from the chat from David Kroll.
Many stimulants are reuptake inhibitors, but so are many antidepressants. Why are antidepressants not abused like stimulants? Why are stimulants not antidepressants?
In fact, actually, stimulants are antidepressants in that they really make you feel great. They are great for your depression for the first 20 minutes or so, and then they're gone. So they do work, just not clinically. The difference between antidepressants and psychostimulants is the major transporters we're looking at. So psychostimulants are things usually associated with dopamine transporter inhibition. They do have serotonin, but the dopamine effects are stronger. With antidepressants, most of the antidepressants on the market are focused on serotonin only. They increase levels of serotonin in the synapse, not dopamine. Some of them do have dopamine effects, but they're very small. And so the effects are primarily serotonergic, and therefore you don't get a high. They also are very, very long acting, very slow. You take them as a pill. You don't tend to feel clinical effects for up to 3 weeks. They're extremely slow, so you're not ever going to get a high off an antidepressant because you're not going to get a rush.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking. I'm here with Cy Curious, postdoctoral researcher with professional interests in neurophysiology, and we're talking about drugs, specifically the ones you use to get high. Now, let's talk about cannabis, because we've received a bunch of emails. And I think we could probably do an entire show on this, and so if enough people write in, maybe we will. But for now, why does it get you high?
Well, cannabis, it does have the dopaminergic effects. It does increase dopamine. It's indirect, though. It's very indirect. Cannabis acts as a cannabinoid. The cannabinoid, the active one, is delta-9-THC, delta-9-tetrahydrocannabinol. And the primary action is that it's a partial agonist. So it activates, but only partially, like 50 to 60% activation of cannabinoid receptors. Convenient naming system. the cannabinoid receptors, what's interesting about them is they're everywhere. Everywhere. Because, you know, the like dopamine receptors, they're concentrated in things like the striatum is one of the areas of the brain. It contains the nucleus accumbens. There are dopamine receptors pretty much all over the brain, but they're not so heavily concentrated. If you wanted to stain for cannabinoid receptors in the brain, your stain would come out black. It is everywhere, all over, high concentrations everywhere. And so some of those areas are dopaminergic, some of them are serotonergic, and you're going to get your subjective effects that way.
Are the neurological effects the same whether we're talking about maybe smoking a joint or hash or oil or baked into a brownie or whatever the case may be?
If it's delta-9-THC, then yes. Okay. The differences, as in it's going to be the same pharmacological, you know, partial agonist at your CB1 receptors.
Gotcha.
What's going to make the experience different is how fast it's coming on. So, for instance, a brownie is going to take a lot longer because it has to go through your gastrointestinal tract. The smoking is going to go on a lot faster. So how long it's on, how much you get, that's kind of going to determine your reaction.
We have an email from David.
It seems like the physical effects of marijuana are really inconsistent. Anything from happy giggling to intense paranoia. Some people can't get off the couch. Some people want to go snowboard. Why is there such a difference?
Well, I mean, the effects of marijuana are very inconsistent, but, you know, so are the effects of alcohol. You have funny drunks, you have depressed drunks, you have annoying drunks, you have, you know, all sorts of different kinds of drunk, right? You have lots of different kinds of high. It's the same with most drugs. There's individual differences. Not everyone is going to get the same dose. Not only that, you have the environment, how you feel about the drug, the experience you are expecting to have. Are you expecting to have a good time? Are you expecting to not like it? Are you expecting your stomach to be upset? That's going to determine how you react to it. If you decide ahead of time that you're really nervous about the marijuana, you're probably going to have a different experience from someone who expects something awesome. I think of it kind of, everyone's brain is different, and the way they react to the drugs will be different because of it. And everyone's brain is different because their experiences are different. I think of it kind of like a roller coaster. It's the same roller coaster, but one person is going to think it's awesome. One person's going to think it sucks. And one person is going to be like, oh, that was fine, but I'm not really going to do it again.
As I said, when I was researching this, all of these topics, quite honestly, I've never felt so old in my entire life. Things have changed, is what I'm saying. How much has marijuana changed over the years?
Marijuana has become a lot more potent over the years. Not so much that, you know, the leaves are bigger, but the concentration of Delta 9 THC has become higher in general by a good bit since the 1960s. And that's because people are breeding the plants for that, you know, high concentration. So it certainly changed in that respect. And of course, you have the synthetics, which I think you're going to talk to David Kroll about.
Absolutely.
The synthetic cannabinoids. And those really have changed how people are taking them.
Well, and I think the big question is for this drug specifically is it addictive?
I mean, well, it's a debatable point.
Obviously.
Right. So the thing is, you can get rats to lever press for cannabinoids. You can. It definitely produces, you know, what we refer to as rewarding and reinforcing effects in animals. It clearly produces them in humans. So on the other hand, it is not as strong. So you'd probably have to do a lot more of it. There are case studies and there are people who come into clinics with addiction to marijuana. It is not as potent as other addictive drugs like cocaine or heroin, but it is probably addictive, yeah.
A question submitted through the website from Dr. Light.
I suffer from a condition that gives me chronic pain. I'm currently on morphine patches. If it were legal in the UK, would I be better off using marijuana for pain relief?
That's a tough question. A lot of these questions are hard. You know, drug research is a very difficult field, politically speaking.
Right.
So basically, first off, I'm not a doctor. I can't tell someone that one drug is going to work better for them. I can tell you that Delta 9 THC does have pain relief effects. It also relieves nausea. They give it to cancer patients to help them eat things, munchies, you know. So basically, it could help with the pain. I would need to see, I'm not sure whether it would be more effective than morphine. You can certainly develop tolerance to both drugs. So it's tough to say whether one would be better than another. I mean, I think there'd have to be a study, like in humans, looking at the comparison between opiates and Delta 9 THC for pain relief. There is no study on that, as far as I know.
So many marijuana questions. This one's from the chat from Bytor.
Is it true that if you quit long-term smoking marijuana, that the effects fade and there are relatively few follow-on problems as compared to the liver damage or other problems caused by alcohol?
The long-term effects of marijuana use, so far, they're pretty minor. The big one has been that there's significant short-term memory loss. That's the big problem. So this is particularly a problem when you're, say, a high school or college student. kind of bombs your test, I guess.
Right.
So there's problems with memory loss in people who smoke a lot of cannabis. I am not sure whether those... I'd have to look that up. I don't know that necessarily, whether that would heal over time, but I can look that up and get back to you.
And another one from Bytor.
How does caffeine compare to all these controlled substances in terms of its effects and potential for addiction?
Woo, caffeine.
Yeah.
My personal favorites. So caffeine is actually, we usually call it a stimulant because clearly it stimulates you. But it's very different from the classic psychostimulants. So instead of working like cocaine and increasing dopamine, norepinephrine, and serotonin, it actually acts on adenosine receptors. Adenosine is a neurotransmitter associated with sleepiness. So adenosine agonists increase sleepiness. Caffeine is an adenosine antagonist, so it, you know, promotes wakefulness. It may have slight cognitive effects associated with increased wakefulness and alertness. It does not appear to increase dopamine in the nucleus accumbens, like drugs of abuse. There's been a couple of studies. It does increase dopamine in other areas of the brain, but not in the accumbens. It has physical withdrawal symptoms, like severe headache, but you're not going to find someone willing to kill their grandma for a cup of coffee. So it's different in those terms. I don't think it's that it, I don't think it's, you know, certainly not as addictive as, you know, cocaine, heroin or anything. I don't think it's necessarily addictive in the classic terms that we use.
And this is a question from Marie Claire from the chat.
Drug education in high schools usually comes from a health education or just say no perspective. Could any of these ideas be useful to integrate into science education?
I really enjoy doing outreach to schools, and I tell them about these things. Actually, most of my outreach is on addictive drugs. And I think it's certainly, I can't speak for anyone but me here. I personally think that it would be useful. I think, first of all, I think you have a right to know what you're putting into your body. You have a right to know how that works. And many kids do not know. I think, you know, certainly you should know what drugs are doing, and not just, you know, cocaine. You should know what aspirin is doing to you. You should know what all of the drugs that you should take and what the foods you eat. You should certainly, I think it would be only good for science education if kids had a really good idea of what the things they were doing to their brains and their bodies.
And we are completely out of time. Sigh. We at Skeptically Speaking love you. Come back anytime.
Oh, thank you.
You can find links to PsyCurious at the PsyCurious Brain on Scientific American and at her blog, Neurotic Physiology, at the link on our site at skepticallyspeaking.com. And we'll be right back to talk with David Kroll about cannabinoids after this.
On the next episode of Skeptically Speaking, we take a close look at the molecular blueprint that our bodies use to build themselves. We'll discuss personal genomics with Dr. Misha Angrist, author of Here is a Human Being, At the Dawn of Personal Genomics. And we'll speak to Dr. Thomas Pearls, director of the New England Centenarian Study, about his work on the Archon Genomics XPRIZE. That's next week on Skeptically Speaking, on your local radio station, or online at skepticallyspeaking.com.
I'm here with David Kroll, professor and chair of the Department of Pharmaceutical Sciences at North Carolina Central University, a historically black college in Durham, North Carolina. David is a natural products pharmacologist focused on the discovery of novel anti-cancer drugs from filamentous fungi, but he teaches widely on other therapeutic natural compounds, including psychoactive drugs from nature. And next month, he'll become the science communications director of the Nature Research Center at North Carolina's State Museum of Natural Sciences in Raleigh. David writes at the Terra Sigillata Pharmacology blog, and less formally at Take As Directed. He's also a monthly contributor to Science-Based Medicine. Welcome, David.
It's a pleasure to be here.
We're talking today about synthetic cannabimimetics. But first of all, what's a cannabinoid?
These are a series of psychoactive chemicals that are made by the marijuana plant, or cannabis sativa. There are probably about 60 different cannabinoids made in different quantities by different types of marijuana plants. But the primary compound for which most of the psychoactive effects are attributed is delta-9 THC, or you'll just hear people refer to it as THC. So all of the compounds made by the marijuana plant are called cannabinoids. The term cannabimimetic refers to a series of synthetic compounds made in the laboratory that were essentially started just as probes for how the active chemicals work in marijuana. So we say that they are mimetics in that they mimic the effect of the endogenous or naturally occurring cannabinoids.
How did they work then?
Actually, just to step back for a minute. So THC was originally identified in the laboratory of Rafe Mechoulam in Israel in 1964 in sort of a search for how do chemicals in marijuana exert their psychoactive effects. And this was actually a very relatively simple compound, very fat soluble. And it was found out later that they interact, these compounds interact with specific receptors in our brain, which were then termed cannabinoid receptors. They go by the term CB1 or CB2, and I believe there are almost a dozen different cannabinoid receptors identified. And the way these things seem to work is they regulate appetite, They regulate perception of visual images. They regulate perception of time. And so this is pretty much how they act.
Now, how are the synthetic versions made?
So the synthetic versions were made really for laboratory purposes. The ones that are being discussed most widely across North America are compounds made by a chemist, a retired chemist named John Huffman, or John W. Huffman, mm-hmm. who used to be at Clemson University in South Carolina. Huffman was working with pharmacologists to try and identify what was the minimum chemical structure that could still have marijuana-like effects on these CB1 receptors. This is a very typical thing in chemistry and pharmacology. It's called structure-activity relationships, where chemists mess with the structure of a compound, and then the pharmacologists test each compound for their activity. And out of that comes a sort of relationship between what parts of the structure are involved with the desired target activity. And so Huffman and his students were doing this work, working with pharmacologists, and published really beginning in the mid-90s a whole series of these compounds that can potentially behave like marijuana, but are synthetic, made in the laboratory.
Is the synthetic version significantly different from the natural version?
Right. So I'm going to have to generalize here mm-hmm. about dozens of compounds, but I think it's fair to say that Huffman's compounds that go by the prefix JWH for John W. Huffman predominantly work like THC on the cannabinoid 1 receptor, but in a more potent and more effective manner. When a drug binds a receptor in the brain, it has the ability to produce a very large effect or a sort of intermediate effect. And we call these compounds either full agonists, meaning that they have the potential for a full effect, or we call these things partial agonists, meaning that they have a sub-maximum effect or partial effect. The naturally occurring THC in marijuana actually is a partial agonist at CB1 receptors. And so what this means is that no matter how much marijuana one smokes or how much THC one dumps into a receptor system, there's only going to be about a 50 or 60% maximal effect on those receptors. The concern and the surprise, I guess, with Huffman's compounds were that many of the JWH compounds have full agonist effects. That is, that they have a maximal effect that's even greater than that of THC. And on top of that, they're more potent, meaning that they can have these activities at lower concentrations than naturally occurring THC.
Now, this may be a silly question, but so why would someone want to make these, sir?
So why would someone want to make them? Well, I mean, outside of the laboratory, you know, this is interesting because, like I said, these compounds were published in the literature over 15 years ago. And what simply happens is regulatory authorities outlaw the naturally occurring compounds or the naturally occurring substance.
Right.
And this occurs with marijuana or hallucinogens like psilocybin from mushrooms. And a series of rather intelligent chemists all around the world scour the literature to try and identify compounds that will get around the regulations in their particular country. And that's really what happened with Huffman's compounds. They were first synthesized for street recreational purposes in Germany and Eastern Europe in the early noughts, and have sort of moved their way across Europe, across Western Europe, and then over to North America over the last 3 or so years.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and I'm talking with David Kroll, professor and chair of the Department of Pharmaceutical Sciences at North Carolina Central University. So can these be used for things that aren't about getting high?
That's a very good question. I think that we really haven't, we meaning the field of pharmacology, hasn't investigated these compounds enough to know whether they'll have therapeutic effects. I mean, marijuana and the pure compounds in marijuana have been investigated for therapeutic purposes really by, you know, traditional drug companies for several decades. And a standardized preparation of THC and one of the other cannabinoids called cannabidiol have been mixed together in a spray, in an oral spray that gets absorbed through the mucosa in your mouth to treat the appetite problems associated with cancer and cancer chemotherapy, as well as the muscle spasticity in multiple sclerosis. So, you know, we've really been investigating how these natural compounds in marijuana could have beneficial therapeutic effects. We're so behind the times in the investigation of the JWH compounds in terms of knowing even how they work in animals. And I think that just the recent attention to the recreational use of these compounds is going to increase at least funding for the study of these compounds in animal models. And then ultimately, we'll see. Maybe they might get to clinical trials at some point down the road.
Well, what kind of the recreational forms might people have heard of?
These are products that are sold as herbal incense or potpourri products. And the idea here is to get around any regulations or laws that prohibit the selling of any drug for intoxicating purposes that's not alcohol or nicotine. And what happens is people who synthesize the compounds then dilute them in an alcohol and spray plant material, an incense-type plant material, with the solution containing these compounds. They're sold in North America under the names of K2, like the mountain, or spice, or black mamba, and there's a whole series of these products. The specific chemicals, though, that people may have heard of if they're shopping in their local smoke shop or looking on the internet will be compounds like JWH-018 or 073 or JWH-250. And then there are a series of other compounds that go by other letters and numbers that are, you know, kind of in the same chemical class.
Well, now, how does this compare to old-fashioned marijuana? You mentioned that the THC was considerably higher.
The issue with these sort of homemade compounds is really twofold. One is these compounds are synthesized under questionable manufacturing practices, if you will.
Right.
Some of the compounds are very carefully made by folks who've been trained in chemistry. Some are made in large laboratories in China and imported, not knowing really what kind of quality. And then the issue is that someone here in North America dissolves the stuff, sprays it on this plant material, mixes it up, puts it in little baggies, and one can have, you know, small amounts on one side and hot spots or heavy amounts on the other. And so it's kind of really a crapshoot as to how much of the psychoactive stuff you're getting in any particular packet that one buys at a, you know, convenience store or online. Granted, those kinds of variabilities occur in different types of marijuana that's sold on the street, depending upon the strain that's used and, you know, what part of the plant is sold and that sort of thing.
Physically or neurologically, would it do anything different than marijuana would?
Now, I haven't tried the stuff myself, but in writing on my blogs, I've gotten probably about 500 comments from users since I first started writing on this in February of 2010. What it sounds like to me is that these compounds have an effect like smoking a lot of really potent marijuana. People report having very rapid heartbeats, muscle sensations, or trembling, tremors. Some people have gone into emergency rooms into epileptic seizures. I think also the desired kind of dissociative psychoactive effect gives way to a very intense paranoia and anxiety, which is described by most readers as being extremely unpleasant and actually somewhat terrifying. As I understand it, there seems to be a very narrow window of pleasant effects of things like K2 or spice.
And so they, for those reasons, obviously, they have been banned in some places, correct?
That's correct. In the United States, at least, different states started enacting their own legislation to outlaw two or three of the compounds, I guess pretty much through 2010. In Canada, the compounds are not They're not explicitly outlawed. I believe they're on your Schedule 2 from Health Canada, mm-hmm. and Health Canada is still analyzing how they're going to be regulated. But at the end of 2010, the U.S. Drug Enforcement Agency took five of the compounds and issued an emergency order to make them illegal for use or possession for a period of 1 year until they examined the science behind these compounds. And so what happened was around Christmas time last year, marketers of these products started switching to new compounds, new JWH compounds that were not explicitly outlawed by the DEA action. And so these kind of second generation spice products are the ones that are being sold on the market now.
And let's just be clear, this is not just for recreational users that this is banned. This is for labs. This is for researchers as well.
Yeah, and this is the problem. There are no research exemptions for these compounds, and so there's a pretty high barrier to studying these chemicals, either in isolated biochemical assays or in even in animal studies. In the U.S., National Institutes of Health has the ability to grant small amounts of the compounds to researchers made through these drug supply contracts that they have with different chemistry groups around the U.S. And I think the same thing holds true in Canada, but it's not as easy to study these things as it was, say, even 18 months ago.
Well, then what are the repercussions to research?
I think at this point, it really depends upon what state you're working in and what your institutional laboratory's relationship is with the local office of the Drug Enforcement Agency. I think it's well understood that it's okay for qualified researchers who are working in the drug abuse area to have access to these compounds, and certainly if they're being supplied by a laboratory that is making those on behalf of NIH, that's not so much of a problem. Where I see a bigger problem for researchers is if you want to take a look, if you're a laboratory that wants to take a look at the content of what's being sold out there. If I were to drive down the street and go to my gas station and purchase the K2 that they have behind the counter, I probably would be in violation of some law. But in order to really understand what kind of risks are out there for public health, you have to have the ability to go buy these, buy the products that kids and other folks are taking or smoking right now.
So where do you think this is going to go then?
Well, this is interesting that you say, where's it going to go now? Because just today in the U.S., I just learned from my neuroscience blogging colleague who goes by Drug Monkey that there is a House bill that's been passed that calls to outlaw a larger swath of these chemically related JWH compounds, and in fact grants the Drug Enforcement Agency another year, so a total of 2 years, to keep these things outlawed until they continue to conduct their public health and poison control type studies. This has happened with a lot of different drugs of abuse, and it's not this synthetic cannabinoid thing's not new. What usually happens is a synthetic compound gets made by clandestine chemists. It gets sold on the street. The regulatory authorities catch up with the chemists, outlaw that compound, and then the chemists have the agility to go and make some analog that has a similar effect. So the laws really tend to chase the chemistry. But there is, in the United States at least, a piece of legislation called the Analog Act to the Controlled Substances Act. And what that says is that if someone is trying to sell something that is like, chemically or biologically, like an outlawed compound, that compound itself is outlawed simply by association.
Interesting.
But the DEA has been very reticent to prosecute people under the so-called Analog Act. I feel like it's almost there to scare people into not messing with things that look like outlawed compounds.
Right. David, great to talk to you. Thanks for being here.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
We've posted links to both of David Kroll's sites, Terra Sigillata and Take As Directed, at skepticallyspeaking.com. While you're there, Click the links to Twitter, to Facebook, or to iTunes, where you can subscribe to the show or leave a review. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week on Skeptically Speaking.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is, 'cause we're skeptically speaking.